In 2003, Brett McNamara was the manager of Nemadji National Park near Canberra. In January that year, after a long spell of bone dry, unsettled weather, a group of isolated bushfires sprung up in and around the park. Then the fires linked up, forming a massive fire front. The fires became so fierce that at one point they formed a fire tornado, a tornado of flame, half a kilometre wide, travelling at speeds of over 30 kilometres an hour. Brett McNamara helped fight the fires for 10 exhausting days. And then on Saturday, January 18, he realised the fires were coming for his beautiful family home. His house had been carefully prepared, the gutters were full of water, the yard was cleared of flammable material, and there was a firebreak of bare soil. But no amount of preparation could account for the size and the ferocity of the inferno that he saw coming to his door. Hello, Brett.
G'day, Regan. How are you?
I'm well, sir. You grew up in Canberra, which, of course, we know is the bush capital of Australia, and it is kind of unique in that you can drive around near Civic and go to, I don't know, Belconnen or Woden or something, and then suddenly you're in bushland for a bit. Does that have anything to do why you chose to become a park ranger living near bushland?
Yeah, look, I've been very lucky, Richard, that I grew up in this city. It's a beautiful city, a city I absolutely love. It is the bush capital for very good reasons.
People don't love Canberra unless they live in it. I think that's
look,
the experience,
it's
isn't
very
it?
True, Richard. It really is. It is a city that you really need to understand the heart and the soul of, and why the city is located where it is, at the foot of the Brindabellas. Look, as you say, as a young child growing up here, I would gaze out across towards the Brindabellas and sort of think, wow, I wonder what's up there. And got involved with Duke and Vandenberg and went out there and exploring. I've got some great fond memories of camping in locations where I now manage through my role as a park manager. So a fantastic city to grow up in, and really, I suppose, gave me that real insight in terms of the connection of the environment and how that environment would shape my life but also shape my career. So, as I say, really am indebted to be born in this beautiful city called Canberra.
So how did you get to become a park ranger?
Well, it's an interesting tale in that, as I say, obviously growing up here in Canberra, finished my education at St Edmunds College back in the 1983, and crossroads in my life. I had some friends going across to Perth. In fact, I remember going down to the bus terminal station with them and they were saying, come on, hop on the bus, let's go to Perth. But I also had a ticket in my pocket, and the ticket in my pocket was to Darwin. And there was just something about the Northern Territory in terms of, again, that environment, that vast openness, that sort of frontier, if you like. And that's what drew me to Darwin, and went up there visiting family and friends, and was very, very fortunate about being able to walk into a job with the Conservation Commission.
Yeah, now, Melanie Tate, who suggested you as a guest on the program, said you began your life as a park ranger in the NT doing all kinds of He-Man things, starting at Uluru. What was the job at Uluru?
Oh, well, the job at Uluru was as a temporary ranger, if you like. I was on a six-month contract when I first started up there, and very early on in my career there, I was exposed to some very interesting moments, particularly with a chappie who had passed away with a heart attack on the side of Uluru within weeks of starting there as a ranger.
He was climbing? He was walking up Uluru?
Yeah, indeed. In fact, if anyone's familiar with that area, there's a chain up there, and the chain's got a bit of a dog leg, and this chappie, his name was Rex. I'll never forget his name. He was an American tourist, and he had a heart attack, and the job I had as a young temporary ranger was picking up rubbish on the side of Uluru, and I was walking up there collecting rubbish, and word came down that a chappie had a heart attack, and I went up and found him there, and his friends were hanging onto the side of him on his belt. He was about to roll off the side of Uluru, and I can remember as a 19-year-old sort of, you know, doing CPR and trying to revive this chappie. So yeah, it was one of those moments where I thought to myself, what a remarkable job this is.
Did you have any of that kind of training? That's not really your job remit, is it, dying tourists?
Yeah, I'd done a first aid course, and obviously because of my involvement back in school with Duke of Edinburgh, I've done first aid courses there, so the principles of CPR were certainly something I was familiar with, but I'd never, ever done it prior to that moment in my life, so...
While you were at Uluru, you must have worked closely with Indigenous people in the area there. Tell me about that.
Yeah, look, that was, again, one of those fascinating insights, the ability to be able to sort of live in that sort of environment. Uluru back in those days was all based around the rock itself. The ranger station, the camps were there, and the Indigenous camp was there as well. And to be able to spend time with people and to really get to understand what is meant by this living with nature was something I think I've taken with me throughout my career.
Did they take you you places and show you things?
Oh, look, one of the jobs I had there was to actually take people out on these bush tucker expeditions that would go on for days on end. We'd go out camping under the stars, looking for mulga in terms of witchy grubs, hunting kangaroos, just spending time with the women and the children, and then wandering off with the men as they would go hunting. And here I am, a 19-year-old, Richard. I mean, 12 yeah. months beforehand, I was in the nation's capital at St. Eddie's, and 12 months later, I'm up in the Uluru, out in the middle of the desert country with Pitjantjatjara people. It was a remarkable.
That can
experience.
Be quite heavenly, can't it? In that kind of country, it's so different from what we know and expect to living close to the coast in Australia.
You know, the thing that struck me up there was the stars.
Yeah.
I'd never ever seen stars as bright as I saw in Central Australia.
And how dark it gets at night too. Like, you know, there's the blackness there.
Yep.
It almost has its own presence. It's almost this kind of void.
Yeah, spiritual. Really is spiritual. You can't help but wake up in the morning and see a sunrise over Uluru and think to yourself, what a remarkable country, what an ancient country this is. And the people that were living in harmony with that country at that time. And I think that is something, that exposure as a 19-year-old, which I had, was just something that, as I say, I've really taken with me for the rest of my professional career.
You attended a funeral for a man called Harry, who was one of the Indigenous Rangers. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Harry was renowned as an Indigenous Aboriginal Ranger, but was really one of his greatest skill was interpretation. He was really keen in terms of engaging people, European people, into the culture that was the Pitjantjatjara people there. But unfortunately, he passed away. And again, as a young 19-year-old, I was asked to help dig his grave. And looking back on it, it was just quite a remarkable experience to try and dig a grave in a desert environment. And I can remember sort of being halfway down this grave and having these boards and trying to keep the sand out and spending days in preparing this grave. And then obviously, having the honour, and it really was an honour to actually be part of the sort of burial and the ceremonies. And what the people there called about sorry business.
What does that mean, sorry
well,
business?
Well, it was one of just, of it's very difficult to describe.
Grief, is it?
Yeah, grief and reflecting and really just sort of understanding the impact that person's life had on the community and the influences that person had. And as I say, as a 19-year-old sort of sitting there in the evenings and sort of being witness to this was truly remarkable.
Your next job after that was to go to Darwin, up to saltwater country. What job did you get up there in Darwin?
Yeah, back in the 1980s, it was really about the crocodile industry. The crocodile industry was just starting to take off. It's a little known fact, Richard, that saltwater crocodiles were once upon a time an endangered species. They were listed as being an endangered species. The Northern Territory government then took a view that there's commercial value in terms of crocodiles, in terms of the skin and the meat. And this is why today we have a crocodile industry up there based around that. But
oddly enough, it sustains the population of crocs, isn't it? It's a kind of a paradox or an irony thing, but yeah, that's the truth.
And look,
isn't it?
An interesting way of actually looking at threatened species in terms of, is there some sort of commercial value here that can be gained, which will in turn, and this is an important point, will help that species recover.
So what was your job with the crocs?
Well, my job up there was twofold, really. It was not only removing problem crocodiles out of the harbour that was posing a threat, but also collecting the eggs.
So how was that put to you, Brett? Welcome to Darwin.
Yes.
Your job, young man, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to go and get crocs out of the harbour and harvest their eggs.
Yeah, looking back on it, it's exactly a bit like that. It was a boy's own adventure.
So how do you catch a croc?
Yeah, with a great deal of difficulty.
And a lot of subtlety.
A
lot of creeping up. So tell me about the process.
Well, the process was pretty simple in that later in the evenings you go out with a boat, obviously, a spotlight and a harpoon. And essentially what you're looking for was an eye shine way off in the distance. And you'd get this eye shine.
Oh, right. So you're firing your torch around.
Yeah, basically.
And wait to see the reflection of the croc's eyes.
Exactly, yeah. And the way that the eyes are structured, you actually get this beautiful pink light bouncing back at you at quite some distance, anything up to 200 odd metres, and you'd hold this croc in your beam. And remarkably, the croc was almost stunned. It was a bit like a rabbit, if you like, on a road, just sort of stunned, sitting there in the water. And you get up very close, and you have this long harpoon. Crocodile skin, my friend, is incredibly tough. It doesn't rip. And it's a small little harpoon with a couple of little hooks on the end of it, and it literally just pricks underneath the skin, and it'll actually hold the croc. So you would actually harpoon the croc.
And what would the croc do once it was harpooned?
It would just take off. The power and the energy of these animals was just incredible.
What's attached to the harpoon?
Basically, a bit of string, and the water would explode. And I still have this vivid recollection of just witnessing the water and the pitch of darkness just exploding, and then this line just running, and there was this whiz sound, and it would actually cut through the water as the croc would just swim. You'd literally then tie that line off to the boat, and then the boat would be dragged around, sometimes up for hours, being dragged around the Darwin Harbour.
For hours, dragged waiting, around by a croc.
Yep, waiting, particularly big crocs, waiting for the croc to basically exhaust themselves. And then once they've got to the stage where they were exhausted, you were then, with this line, drag this animal back towards the boat.
How sure are you the croc's exhausted, though?
Well, it would take a little bit of thrashing and carrying on. And the most remarkable part, in thinking back on it, occupational health and safety wasn't quite sort of on top of my mind. Then you would then lean over the side of the boat and actually then tie the jaws together. And that in itself was an art form. There was a particular knot that we used to use, a surgical knot, to actually tie the jaws together. And then the hardest part then, Richard, was to actually get the animal inside the boat. And there were times when the boat, the little tingy that we were in, was smaller than the crocodile which we'd harpooned. So we'd drag this animal back to the boat ramp and then tie it onto a croc board and then take it off.
Is there enough money in the world to make that a worthwhile job, I wonder?
Yeah, as I say, you know, looking back as a 19, 20-year-old, it was an amazing experience, only to be coupled by the going out into Arnhem Land and collecting eggs. We'd go out there and we'd find these nests, and a croc, mother croc, would actually have a little moat around the eggs, around the nest there, and she'd actually lie in wait while the eggs were sort of hatching. The job I had was then with an oar, and we'd land in a helicopter in these remote locations, and I'd have this oar, and you'd be pushing your way through the pandanus grass, and you'd come across the nest, but you'd then have to find where the mum was, and she'd be in this little moat outside the nest, and you'd poke it with the oar, and she would, and the water explode, and she'd grab hold of this oar. So my job was to hold this thing with the oar, and the other guy's job was to raid the nest and then to take the eggs back. So looking back on it, you're sort of thinking, how did we survive all of that? But somehow we did.
I should just point out I'm clutching my legs and rocking backwards and forwards at the moment. That's somehow you did, and you're all right. Just counting your limbs and your fingers, they're all there.
Yes, they are.
You must have been good at the job.
Well, in fact, it was all about teamwork too. And these sorts of things just don't happen as an individual. And the guys that I worked with up there were just real professionals. But we enjoyed ourselves and we kept each other safe.
So after your stint in the Territory, you came back to Canberra and you had a job as a senior park ranger. And tell me about where you lived and how you got set up there.
Yeah, look, I was very, very fortunate when I came back to the ACT in 1990 in that I walked into a job up at Bendora Dam, which literally is a long stone throw from where we're sitting in the studio, Richard, up in the Brindabellas, the majestic, the beautiful Brindabellas. Lived up there with my then wife. We were very, very fortunate too also for our children to be able to take their first steps in the Brindabellas. And it was a really special part of my life and look back on it with very, very fond memories.
Quite an isolated spot there, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you would have had all that bushland around you and not many signs of human habitation at all.
No, exactly. In fact, Bendora, and it still is today, it's the most remote work location anywhere in the ACT. But again, given the fact that I just spent 8.5 years in the Northern Territory, to have to spend an hour and a half driving from Canberra up to Bendora was nothing compared to sort of having to drive 3 hours down to Katherine. So I think that sense of the Territory in isolation and distance and the tyranny of distance of the Territory compared to Canberra was nothing. So really just moved into Bendora, and to be honest with you, mate, I thought I had the best job in the world, and looking back on it, I really did.
So then you moved after a while to Tidbinbilla, where the space tracking station is quite famously.
Yeah.
And tell me about the house you set up there, because this is the house in question, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, look, I was very fortunate that a house became available at Tidbinbilla Nature Reserve, which was literally just on the other side of the range. So by this stage, the kids, Jordan and Gemma, were beckoning for an education, and they were actually enrolled at the local school down at Tharwa, local preschool and the primary school down there. And I'd risen through the ranks, and I'd then become the manager of Namadgi National Park. And life was great, in a job which I loved, living at Tidbinbilla Nature Reserve with just magnificent views, a beautiful lifestyle.
Describe the house, because the house was special, wasn't it?
Yeah, the house was very, very special. It was actually built back in the 1960s and architecturally designed, and it had these beautiful windows that faced towards the west. And you'd wake up in the middle of winter and just see the Brindabellas and the Tidbinbilla Range snow-capped. Had this beautiful open fireplace, and you'd sit in there in winter and look out, and the kangaroos would just come up to the house. It was a beautiful big open house, a beautiful environment, and as I said, we were really living in harmony with the bush out there.
Did you have any experience with bushfires before the 2003 fires?
Look, to be very honest, very limited. I'd been to a couple, I suppose, what we would now call little billy can fires, where a small little fire had started and we got around it pretty quickly. But yeah, it's one of those things where you can do a lot of training, and which we did. You can do a lot of courses. But fire is one of those things that you sort of Mother Nature teaches you a lot about fire.
When I lived in Canberra, I can remember every once in a while, or very occasionally, Mount Ainslie would catch fire, and you'd see it looked like something from a Bosch painting, you know, there'd be this flaming mountain in the distance there, and that would be put out. So there was a kind of an awareness in Canberra that bushfires could be a problem, they could come by. Yep. Was there in any sense that, was there any anticipation that a bushfire could ever be quite so big as the ones that came? Was there a different mentality back then?
Yeah, look, I can only speak from my own experience. And I don't think there were these small little fires, and we always thought that somehow that, you know, being humans, we'll be able to control fire, we'll be able to get out there and put these fires out.
We are the masters of the earth.
Exactly, yeah. And I must admit, looking back, I probably had that mentality as well, thinking that, you know, we've got the technology and the machinery, we can deal with this. But as it turned out, that was something very, very different.
The 8th of January, 2003, some isolated fires sprung up. How did they start? What do we know about that?
Yeah, look, that day I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was a day where it was a dry lightning strikes just rolled across the Australian Alps. There were hundreds of lightning strikes. But here in the ACT, we had four lightning strikes. And I can remember the towers, the fire spotting towers, calling in the smoke, and remember being responded to one of those lightning strikes myself. We had difficulty actually getting to the base of this particular lightning strike there. For 10 days, I got to know those areas very, very well. And again, because of living up in the Brindabellas, I knew that area like the back of my hand. I knew exactly where the locations of these fires were, how best to get into it as well. So,
were you on top of it for a while? Were you able? You're not a fire ranger, of course, but you're a park ranger. Was there a feeling like for a little while there, oh, we can get on top of this, we can manage these little billy can fires?
Yeah, looking back, yes, certainly in those early days there, we thought that we pretty much would have these things wrapped up within a matter of days. But it was interesting how it all unfolded. I can remember like it was yesterday, that the 13th of January, which is the day when a helicopter crashed in Bendora Dam.
Now tell me that story. That's an extraordinary story.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story of survival in that the helicopter was involved with firebombing operations. And
so it had a giant tub of water.
A Bambi bucket, and it was actually filling up from the dam and then taking water up onto the fire at Bendora there. But unfortunately, something happened and the machine went down. And I can remember hearing on the radio that it was a machine down in the Bendora Dam. And it's just one of those things you think, you know, like, how bad can this possibly get? It can't get any worse than actually having a helicopter crash in Bendora Dam.
Did it crash into the side of a hill or a mountain?
No, actually into the water itself. From the top it went upside down. The pilot was unconscious. He was dragged out.
Was that the moment when the Chief Minister stepped in and saved someone's
indeed,
life?
Indeed, yes. Yeah, a couple of people up there and Peter Lucas-Smith and the former Chief Minister, John Stanhope, and pulled Duncan Patrick out of the water. Duncan was unconscious. They revived him on the side of the water, of the dam there. And it's a great story in that today Duncan's now regained his chopper's licence and he's flying again. But at that point in time, a lot of us thought, you know, this is as bad as it's going to get. Little did we know that 5 days later, Armageddon would be unleashed onto us.
What was the thing? How did it happen that you went from a bunch of isolated fires then to a massive fire front?
Yeah, well, I suppose for me, as I say, the calling card came on the 18th. I worked the night shift of the 17th and was absolutely exhausted. And I can remember sort of waking up in the morning and seeing the fire crown on the top of the Timpinbilla Range. You don't see that first thing in the morning. There's fire up in the canopy, and it was at that stage we thought we better get the kids out. The house had been prepared. You know, there'd been water running over the gutters. We'd cleared a break around it, and I remember taking the kids into town and then returning to fight the good fight. But little did I know, it was all going to go very, very pear-shaped very, very, very quickly.
So you could see the fires coming towards the house. You got the kids out and you returned to the house. Yep. What did you think you could do? What did you think you might be able to achieve returning to the house?
Well, one of saving the house. And again, it was sort of this false sense of security because we'd built this containment line around it. I actually had a light unit with me as well. The house had been prepared that somehow would be able to sort of stand there and to ward off this impending fire as it was sort of raining down on the house. But it wasn't the case at all.
what was operating there at the time, as we now know, it's been the first confirmed fire tornado that I mentioned right at the start there, a fire tornado that was half a kilometre wide, travelling at over 30 k's an hour. Did you witness that itself, that tornado, that column of fire?
Yeah, we were on the edge of it. And basically what happened there was these fires, as they joined, then formed this massive column of fire tornado. And Timpanbilla at that stage was right on the edge of it. The noise was something that I will take to my grave.
Can you liken it to anything?
Oh, look, you can't. It's deafening. It's a roar. It's an angry roar. It was something like a freight train bearing down on us, and that noise is something which is sort of, I can still hear it today. I really can. I can hear that noise in my head today. The intensity of the ember attack that then we found ourselves in was just incredible.
Yeah, like you said, the roar of it, I was reading from the research into it, the force of it was actually tossing cars off the road. It was that fierce. And unlike a normal tornado, if there is such a thing, that comes out of a cloud, it's anchored to a cloud. This was anchored in the ground, so it never left the ground.
Yeah.
And it was that fierce. Mm. So you're living on the edge of it. This is on the edge of this. Yeah. And your home, who came back to your home with you? Did you have anyone with you back at your house?
Yeah, look, I had a couple of guys that came back with me. Jeff Filmer and Wayne, guys that I've sort of, in fact, I still work with Wayne today, and every now and then we look at each other and just sort of think to ourselves, how the hell did we survive that? So when we got back to the house there, because my history, I suppose, we briefed each other in terms of what we would do and what we were going to sort of try to protect the house.
And what condition were you in? Because you'd been fighting fires for 10 days.
Yeah.
At that point. What state were you in, Brett?
Just exhausted. And I was operating on just sheer adrenaline, looking back on it.
And as you saw the fires coming towards you, what was the weather like?
Night turned into day turned into night. It was just black. It was just red. It was just angry. It was one of those moments that you think of a Hollywood movie set, and that's what it was like, being inside this tornado, this cyclone of fire, being engulfed. It was just incredible.
What did you have with you that you were going to fight the fire with?
Yeah, a light unit, which is
it's a
small little appliance with a bit of water on the back of it and a couple of hoses. And we'd sort of positioned that in such a way that we thought as a fire front would pass us, we'd be able to sort of knock down the flames. But as it turned out, it was completely useless. It didn't do anything.
As I said, the house was protected. Your then wife had taken steps to protect the house. There was, water in the gutters?
Yep.
And a fire break around it?
Yep.
Well-watered lawn, all of those things.
Yeah, looking back, you sort of think, yeah, that should be fine. The house should be protected.
What were you wearing? What kind of protective gear did you have on?
Yeah, look, I was very, very fortunate, Richard. The fact that I was actually wearing full fire protection equipment, so it was the pants, it was the jacket and the helmet, and also face cloth. Without that, and wearing that equipment, I wouldn't be sitting here today. It's as simple as that.
So there you are, and then the fire front is then upon you at the house. What happened when the fire came to you? You mentioned an ember storm. What was that?
Yeah, the embers is basically material that was alight. The size of your fist, your forearm, logs just flying through the air that were actually alight. And I remember being pelted and being knocked to the ground to the point where the face cloth that I had on my face actually caught alight. And I can remember just peeling this face cloth off and just thinking that, this was not good, and that I needed to do something. I needed to do something quickly to get out of there.
Did you get burnt from the face cloth?
Yeah. I lost the tip of my nose as a result of just being pelted by these embers. And I can remember crawling across to the spa, an outdoor spa we had there, and I can remember just getting inside the spa. But the spa was actually alight. It was quite remarkable. And being fiberglass, it was melting. And I can remember lying in this water, looking up, and there's flames just dancing all over the place, and the fiberglass just melting on top of me, and thinking I've got to get out of here. And
what was the water like?
Well, it was almost bubbling. It was just the noise, the smoke, and the heat, the intense heat of being engulfed inside this sort of firestorm. It was just incredible.
Did it occur to you in that moment that you were going to die?
Oh, look, very much so. Oh, very much so. I crawled out of that spa, and I can remember just going around to the side of the house and just sort of getting into the into a fetal position almost, and just sort of just almost rocking myself backwards and forwards, thinking that this was going to be the end. And I really did. I honestly did. I really thought at that moment that it was all over.
Were there flames overhead?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was completely engulfed. Completely engulfed. It was like I just looked up and it was just fire and heat and noise. And because of the gear I had on, I just sort of protected myself. I remember just sort of rolling myself up into a ball and just roll, yeah, tight little ball. And it's this fire. It was just all around me.
Do you have a sense of how tiny you are as a single human being thing?
Yeah, yeah. When you're engulfed in a fire like that, you are just so insignificant. You really are. It's the force of nature was just incredible.
Conversations with Richard Feidler. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
Today I'm with Brett McNamara. Brett is Regional Manager of ACT Parks and Conservation Service. He's been a park ranger all his adult life. 2003, he was the manager at the Madgee National Park outside of Canberra when the Canberra bushfires approached and eventually came to his house, his beautiful architect-designed house in the bush. And he went there to try and fight it with two friends and colleagues. So you had to get out of the spa bath outside because it was the fiberglass was melting and the water was starting to boil. Mm. And you're at the side of the house. You went inside after that?
Yeah, look, I had this sort of idea of, you know, where were Wayne and Jeff? I had no idea where they were. And honestly, I thought that they'd been trapped in the vehicle. A tree had fallen across and I couldn't quite see where the vehicle was and I thought they'd been trapped in there. So I made my way inside the house to the study there and there they are standing in the study with milk. You're thinking, why have they got milk?
Milk?
Milk.
What were they doing with milk?
They were pouring the milk over their face, over their eyes.
Why? Yeah.
Well, it was because it was just the smoke was just everywhere and they just had to get this smoke out of their eyes. So I got this recollection of standing there in the study and this milk going all over the place. And I'm thinking to myself, how am I going to explain the fact that there's milk all over the carpet?
Was it the only fluids that they had, was it?
Exactly, yes, yes. All the pumps had power been turned off. We had no water. There was no water out of the tap. So the only liquid they could find to soothe their eyes was this milk. So I can remember standing there myself as well and just putting milk all over my face and carrying on and the things that you do and the things you think about. Meanwhile, you know, the fire is dancing outside of the house.
Yeah, what could you see outside the windows of your house?
Yeah, well, I walked down towards the kitchen and the kitchen had this beautiful view out towards the northwest and, of course, that's where the fire was coming. And by that stage, it was just flames dancing. It was almost mystical the way these flames were just dancing. And I can recall putting my hand up towards the glass to touch this glass and the wind. Window then just smashed open, and these fingers of flames were just licking, coming in like they were trying to lick the ceiling around me. It was surreal. It was quite surreal.
Did it feel like they were? Like they were grabbing for you?
Yeah,
in a way.
Yeah, and you sort of get this sense that there's this monster sort of just trying to sort of engulf you.
Get into the house.
Yeah, I can remember just turning and walking and past Gemma's bedroom, and her bed was against the far wall from a window, and there were flames just dancing all over her bed and a dollhouse that she had there. And as she sat, you know, a couple of days before at this dollhouse playing with these dolls, the fire was just dancing around her dollhouse her bed was alight. And then it's quite surreal, actually. I remember just walking very calmly towards the end of the house and saying to these guys, look, come on, it's time to get out.
You were calm.
Yeah, in the middle of all of that, I can just remember this sense of being very, very much in the space in terms of the need to get out of the house.
You're in that kind of part of the brain that can get very, very pragmatic.
Mm. Oh yeah, yeah, very much so. Yeah, it was almost, you know, this is what we need to be doing, but we need to be doing it calmly. Unfortunately, beforehand, the fire had hit, we talked about a safety zone, and safety zone was basically an area which had already been previously burnt. So very, very calmly, we just sort of just walked out to this area that was being blackened and just sat there and just the three of us just sat there and just watched the house burn.
What does that look like to watch your house burn down?
Oh, look, it was gut-wrenching. I mean, to sit there and to sort of watch your house and all your family possessions just to burn. But the noise, the corrugated iron being peeled off this house, it was like the house was groaning. You know, like you peel a banana skin. It was like it was being peeled and peeled apart by this fire, and corrugated iron just flying with the cyclonic winds. It was, yeah.
What, the roof? This, you're talking about the roof here, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What, it just peeled up and then blew away?
Yeah, literally. And then just get wrapped around like tissue paper, corrugated iron being peeled off like tissue paper. But the sound of corrugated iron, that noise. So we just sort of sat there and... In fact, I've got a vivid recollection of actually asking for a smoke for some strange reason.
You didn't ask for a lighter, did you? Know what I mean,
no, I think we
did. Really, it was like that. You were standing there asking for a cigarette. What do you talk about with your friends when you're watching this happen?
I really can't quite recall. The conversation was, I think we probably exchanged a couple of expletives, like, what was that all about?
Yeah.
And are you okay? But it was a you okay sort of thing.
And how were they faring, Jeff and Wayne?
Were they burned? Oh, yeah, we're all in shock looking back on it now. We're all in shock. You know, it was just something. It was just so surreal.
How long did you wait there in the burnt out area? Oh,
probably only minutes, but it felt like it was hours. Time stopped. It really did. Time honestly stopped. It was just this surreal experience of just sitting there and just watching the house then fold in on itself. Amazing.
And was there a sense that the fire had passed? It was sort of it had formed. This blackened out. It sort of consumed whatever fuel it could find, and then was moving on.
Yeah, obviously the main fire front had moved on, and then had hit Birragai, the education centre, which was on the other side of the ridge, and we continued to sort of move in towards town, so into Canberra. So by this stage, it was just a smouldering remains of the house, and we decided it was time to move back down towards the visitor centre at Timpanbilla there. So we drove down towards Timpanbilla, and there were people actually there taking refuge from this firestorm that had engulfed Timpanbilla, and I can remember actually seeing trucks in the middle of the car park out at Timpanbilla there with their tyres smouldering because of the embers that had been pushed up against the side of the tyres, and these vehicles were on light.
What had happened to your fire protective gear at that point, your helmet and everything else?
Yeah, well, I'd lost the helmet in the cyclonic winds, and it was only a couple of days later when we went back out to Timpanbilla to sort of shift through the ashes of the house that I've actually found the helmet, and the helmet had melted. These helmets are designed not to melt, but this helmet had melted. And then somehow it'd been run over by a truck as well, so it's cracked. So I've got this, and it still sits on my desk down the office. It's this little bit of a memento I've kept of
melted, cracked helmet.
Thankfully my head wasn't in it, Richard.
Yeah, indeed. We wouldn't be having this conversation.
No, we wouldn't be.
So on the drive back, drive out then, leaving behind the ruined house, what was it like to be reunited with your family who were all safe and well?
Yeah, that was pretty remarkable. I think looking back on it too, I was obviously in shock. I can remember sort of walking into a friend's place and you know, the kids being there and everyone being there and just collapsing. I honestly remember just collapsing and feeling like I was sleeping for days.
But you were burned. Did you get your burn seen too?
Yeah, no, I think it was a few days later. It wasn't sort of, as they say, top of mind. It was more sort of trying to recover from that experience, but yeah.
What was it like to wake up the next day after all this? This horror.
Look, yeah, it's difficult to describe. The best way of describing is that moment you wake up and you realise you haven't got a coat hanger. When you've got to go out and buy yourself a coat hanger, you know you've lost everything. You know, when you move, you've always got something, and usually you've got coat hangers and a few things like that. But there was a point in our lives where we woke up and we had nothing except the clothes I was wearing and a couple of things that Michelle had grabbed out of the house. But having to go down to the recovery centre and sort of say, oh, by the way, would you have a coat hanger? It's great that I've got a new shirt, but I need something to hang it on. That was one of those moments you go, wow, I've lost everything.
So you and the family then had to go out and buy clothes after that.
Yeah. And look, one of the things that happened in Canberra, if people were in Canberra when this happened, they know what I'm talking about in terms of the outpouring. It was just overwhelming. These recovery centres that were set up was just incredible. To go into these places and just to feel the compassion and the sympathy that the community had towards people who had lost their homes was overwhelming.
Where would you get money from? Because I'm assuming you would have lost your credit cards and whatever cash.
Yeah.
You would have had literally no money.
Yeah, no. And your personal identity, and that's a point. And this is what I can relate to people who lose their houses today. Unless you lose your personal sense of identity. You haven't got your passport. You've got to start your life all over again. But well, I was very fortunate again with work. We really were engulfed by the compassion of the community and the arms of the love of the community, and really helped us get through that.
Oh, people can be just lovely in that situation, can't they?
A quick story. I remember going to the bus depot markets afterwards, and a lady had recognised our plight and sort of had seen where we had come from, and she came up to us with a little wooden box. Oh, sorry. And her brother had died a couple of years beforehand, and she knew that sense of loss, had lost everything, and she gave us this little wooden box, and I've still got this wooden box today. It was one of the very first things that we were given after the fires was this wooden box. So quite amazing compassion.
How are your kids coping? They were what, 5 years old and 8 years old?
They did it pretty tough because, living out in the Brindabellas and then Timpinbilla, you don't have lights at night time. You don't have garbage trucks coming through in the middle of the mornings. So adjusting to life in an urban setting for them was a bit of a challenge in those sort of early months, and we moved back into town. But
lost all their toys too.
I can always remember Jordan saying there one day that he didn't want all these toys that he was getting from the centres. He wanted his own toys back, and that was a pretty tough moment, yeah.
In the greater area, how much bushland had been burnt down in that national park that you were manager of?
Yeah, look, well over 95% of the park had been affected in some capacity. There was canopy fires. It had been completely reshaped by that firestorm. So a park that I knew so well, a park that I loved so well, and I suppose just looking back on it was interesting because I had that double whammy of not only the personal experience but also then professionally coming back into an environment that had been completely changed.
So how soon did you get back to work?
Yeah, look, you know what, Richard, looking back on it, I probably went back a little bit too early. I probably should have taken a lot more time in terms of my own sort of mental recovery from it. But, literally within a couple of weeks I was back at work and, trying to put things back together again. I think it's an interesting thing about human nature too. We try to fix things very quickly, and I was into that mentality as well. Well, something's happened, hang on, we've got to fix it. Let's clean everything up and fix things. But
you can't fix a national park, can you?
No.
I mean, well, humans can't, can they? I mean, isn't the best way to fix a national park that's been burned out just to leave it alone?
Yeah. Look, it's something that I've really come to appreciate as the years have rolled on, in that we as park managers, we don't manage that natural environment. The environment manages itself. It's been crafted and moulded by Mother Nature, if I could use that expression, for millenniums. Our role as park managers is really to manage people, the impact of people in and on that landscape. And, nature has a great way of nurturing and healing itself. And I suppose in some ways, my recovery, if you like, from 2003 was really taking a leaf out of nature's book in terms of, letting nature nurture itself, heal itself, and learning from nature, taking time. That's the most important thing.
As bushfires have been destroying that national park for thousands and thousands of years every 100 years, every 200 years or thereabouts, I'm guessing that would be the case, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
There's nothing new about it in so many ways.
No,
there?
And that's the thing. I think people do say it's been destroyed, but I don't see it as that. No. I see it as being crafted and being moulded, and that's the environment which we have out there. So it's as a result of nature. We can learn a lot from nature. We really can.
How are you going afterwards?
Yeah, look, looking back on it now, with hindsight, probably a bit ordinary back then.
That sounds like a real understatement to me. You must have suffered a fair bit of, I don't know what you'd suffer. I really don't know, actually. Lost grief or relief or all those things?
I think, to be honest with you, Richard, probably today we'd probably call it post-traumatic stress. I think that's how it would be diagnosed. But again, it's one of those things where you just sort of take things day by day and sort of learn from nature, as I say, and really that's sort of been, I suppose, the journey that I've been on all these years later. It's one of looking back, reflecting on, not dwelling on so much, but really taking some moments in your life where you sort of think, wow, that was an amazing experience, and that's how I look at it.
It wasn't your fault in any way, but did you nonetheless blame yourself in any way?
Oh, look, you do have those moments. You do the old what if only we'd done this, if we'd done that. But as we say, the fact that we were engulfed in a tornado.
Yes, if you'd hosed down the driveway, that wouldn't have been much help, Brett, would it?
On that day, nothing would have made any difference at all. So, no. Mm.
Was it hard to find another house to live in after that?
Yeah, look, that was a bit of a struggle because, like a lot of people who lost their homes in Canberra, we were sort of thrown into the market of rental and looking for accommodation, and that's a double whammy as well, having to spend your days checking out houses, and it's not quite the house you had, and you're not in that mental space, you're not in that right space of mind where you sort of thinking, oh wow, this would be great, another new house, let's move into that one. It's like, you know, this is not what we had. I want what we had again, but obviously we couldn't.
There was a coronial inquiry afterwards, after the fires. What was that like to participate in that?
Yeah, look, that's an interesting point, I suppose, and it's about the sort of the inquisitive nature of humans. We want to know what happened, and surely someone or something has to be held accountable for that.
Oh, someone had to be found to blame?
Yeah, that's my personal experience and my sense of it as well. And obviously, you know, what happened then, it was nature. It was nothing that we could have done on that particular day. So, yeah, I spent a couple of days in the witness box and being asked some interesting questions and, you know, wouldn't you agree, Mr. McNamara, in hindsight, you could have done this, you could have done that? And, you know, looking back, probably yes. But when you're in that moment, we did our best. And that's an important point too. And it's still the case today, Richard, with the fires that ravage across the Australian landscape. You know, people are doing their best. They're trying to, you know, keep people safe.
It's a little bit galling to be asked that question by someone who didn't live through it.
Oh, yeah, it is. But you can understand why. It's part and parcel of the process. So I just hope that as time rolls on, that we're a little bit kinder to one another, you know, when these things happen. And they will happen. They will continue to happen as well. We will continue to have fire in this landscape. So let's just try and be a bit kind to one another post the event.
It's more than a decade since it happened, and you've been watching it recover.
Yep.
If recover is even the word, renew itself is probably a better word, isn't it, actually?
Mm.
What's that like? What kind of things do you witness when you see that process, that slow process of renewal of a national park happen?
Yeah, well, what we bared witness to was a landscape building event. We were witnessing nature in terms of her ability to be able to craft that landscape. One of the iconic features of Nemadji is the granite boulders out there, these beautiful, large, round rocks, granite rocks. And I can remember flying around afterwards and seeing these rocks peel like an onion. It's what we call exfoliation, and there's this sort of new life being given. And
what do you mean? How does a rock peel?
Yeah, well, just literally like an onion. Think of an onion and the way it just peels away, and the fire actually would sort of heat up these rocks in such a way that would form these cracks, and these rocks would then just literally just peel away. Those rocks then break down. It's those granite soils that then break down that come to form the alluvial soils that are on the plains or where the farmers are now. So we're witnessing that. It was quite remarkable.
So the fire cracks open a rock, which disintegrates the fragments, and then that then adds nutrition to the soil.
Exactly. And then, of course, afterwards, we then have these storm events, these gully rakers of storms, where the water would then cascade off these mountains and bring all this material down. And just watching the vegetation recover, there's this sort of green fur look of epicormic regrowth. It was, it was quite remarkable. And we're still witnessing that today.
There was a population of frogs that were threatened too. What, tell me about how you intervened or didn't intervene
there.
Yeah,
look, it's a very interesting point there about sphagnum bogs up in the hills. And Crobbery frogs are an endangered species, and their habitat is sphagnum. Sphagnum is like a sponge. It holds and retains water. But because it had been infected by the fires, it had lost its ability to hold the water in that landscape. And we had water literally incising, cutting through. And I can remember having meetings with people saying, we must get up there with the engineers and fix this. We'll get up there with dozers and we'll fix it all. But then we had this moment where, hang on, why don't we just work with nature and slow down that water by putting straw bales up there? So that the technique was actually a hand-in-glove approach with nature. And to this day, that has worked. It doesn't always require an engineering fix. What it requires is an ability to be able to read and to work with nature in harmony. And that's what we did with the sphagnum bogs. And to this day, it's a credit to all those staff that have been involved over many, many years that we have this functioning ecosystem as a result of working in harmony.
So then the point is to, just yesterday I was speaking to a scientist, an electrical engineer, who was part of the space tracking program of the Apollo missions. And in that situation, it's really the best thing to do is to push human endeavor as hard as you can, really, forward. But this seems like just the opposite. It seems like the lightest possible touch is the most appropriate one.
Yeah, no, exactly. And as I say, you know, nature has been crafting and molding for millenniums. And I think we need to understand and appreciate that sometimes it's better off just to step back, to take a deep breath, and to contemplate and to read that landscape out there. So, the soft approach is sometimes the best approach.
I know that personally after the fires, you had a terrible time of things. A lot of things went great in your personal life Does that work for people too, that long and slow process of renewal, if you have some patience?
Yeah, look, very much so. And that's something that I've taken over the last few years, is that, you know, life is really all about chapters in my mind. And from each chapter, you draw experience, you draw some resilience, you draw a sense of purpose, and then you sort of move on with your life into the next chapter. And, that's something that I suppose has at my core, yeah.
Are you different since the fires?
Oh, look, very much so. I think I have a lot more sort of empathy towards those that experience those sorts of moments in your life where you take that deep breath. I think it's the compassion that I felt afterwards is something that I'd like to be able to sort of give back. And obviously, because of my role now, I'm involved with fire still, and I can recall being up in Blue Mountains there last year and seeing people have lost their family home up in the Blue Mountains. And I can remember stopping and having a chat to them and seeing in their eyes this grief, this sense of loss, and just being able to try to say to them, look, you know, you'll get through it. You will get through this.
Did you get a sinking feeling approaching the fire zone like that again, it's the terror again, or are you past that now, Brett?
Yeah, no, I still do. And interestingly, that face cloth I mentioned, I carry that around in my fire jacket.
The one that burnt off your face, yeah, and burnt the tip of your nose.
Yeah.
You've got it in your fire jacket?
Yeah, I carry that in my fire jacket.
Why?
Oh, it's just one of those little keepsakes. You just every now and then, it's just something that I know it's there. And I've been in a couple of situations since 2003 where I thought, I just touched this little thing in my pocket and sort of think, yeah, if I can get through 2003, we can get through whatever we're facing now.
I see you wearing a pin which has the Australian flag and the Canadian flag right next to it. What's your Canadian experience with fires, Brett?
Yeah, like I was very, very fortunate. A couple of months ago, I was selected along with 7 or 8 other Australians to go across to British Columbia to help them with their firefighting effort over there. And that was a truly remarkable experience to be able to represent Australia and the local fire brigade here and assisting the British Columbians with their fire. It was, and it's a different country over there too, Richard. It's quite remarkable. But again, the principles of firefighting are very universal, and that sense of actually trying to help one another, you know, walking through some of these remote communities in BC and just people coming up to us and sort of thanking us for being there. As I said to people, it was a privilege and honour to go over to help them. And I know if we had problems here, they would be over here like a flash.
Do you remember? Do you now know in your bones? Like, I had an experience once where I went out in a beach unaccompanied, there was no one there, and I got caught in a rip and I nearly drowned. And I used to think that the beach and water were, I used to think the ocean was a really benign place. Mm. And then I kind of realized in that moment that I was like a dot in the landscape.
Yep.
And really the ocean didn't care about me, which is a terribly narcissistic view, I know, but there you go. It's a brutal awakening it was. And needless to say, I survived. Did you have a similar experience with that, with the fires?
Oh, look, very much so. You really feel so insignificant when you're in the middle of a firestorm like that. And in some ways, it's quite an awe-inspiring experience to be able to witness something as ferocious as a fire, but at the same time understand that it's a natural part of the ecosystem. It's almost a contradiction in terms of how fire can be so dangerous and deadly, yet in some ways, critical to the environment that we now love in Australia. It's something we really need to be able to, learn to live with, as opposed to sort of trying to control. We can't control fires. Not fires like that one.
What an amazing story, Brett. I'd love having you on the program today. Thank you so much for telling your story.
Absolutely. Welcome.
Thank you for downloading this podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.